Hello, everybody, and welcome to Patriotic Weekly Review, episode number 364. And we're here tonight on Rumble and Odyssey, and Rumble and Odyssey alone, with the wonderful Morgoth, who I'll be introducing shortly. Now, let's get into what I've got planned for the rest of the week and what I've been up to this week. Well, Monday I did my show with Patrick Slattery on the Republic Broadcasting Network. I have done an interview today with a woman for YouTube, so that will be coming out shortly, and I'll share that. I published a Substack article on Tuesday, and you really want to check that out. So I'm new to Substack. I'm on Substack. Go and support me there. Make sure you subscribe to me, and you can also financially support me there. And I've got a new article out on Substack called Vote Harder, The Failed Micro-Party Strategy. And this analyzes the election results, not from the big picture perspective, but from the little picture perspective, i.e. the small nationalist parties. And I basically concluded, we go over and see what my conclusion is, but have a look at the article. It's a very important article. Please go and check that out. Now, I'm also working this week. On Thursday, I'll be live with Dr. David Duke. On Friday, I'll have a stream. I will also have another Substack article published on Friday. This one is about a judge who has chosen to add a terror certification to a trial secretly without telling the defendants or the jury. And now the defendants have been found guilty. They're actually potentially facing terror sentencing, which is incredible, because to do that in secret is a complete subversion of the English legal system. And of course, you might have guessed, it's because these people did something that the judge deemed was against the Israeli government. So check that out. And then on Sunday, we've got a film review, Apocalypse Now, with Tom Sewell. So loads of stuff coming up this week. Now, if you like my work, if you like everything I do, please do consider giving a donation. You can only donate live through the show on Rumble now. Please help me out there. I do need your support. Or if you prefer, go over to Substack and subscribe to me there. You can subscribe to me on Substack. You can leave differing amounts. It really, really helps. I've got a number of good articles there. I think I've already published 11 articles and I'm doing two a week. So you can support me over on there. Now, nothing I do goes behind a paywall. My Substack is free to read. So please do support it if you can. Support me through Rumble tonight and get those super chats in. Any good questions, well, any questions or statements, we'll read out in the second half of the show. Obviously, Entropy is gone now, so that's the only way you can help me, and I do need your help. You can also support me through Crypto. The Crypto link's in the description below, and you can write to me at mark@thefallofwesternman.com. So again, my plea is go over to Substack and subscribe to me. Saying that for some reason is a bit of a tongue twister, but please do go to Substack. The links are in the description of the show and in the pinned comments. So if that's one way you would like to support me, please do. And look, we're going to have thousands of people watch this stream over the course of the next few days, over the course of the week. All of you, go over to Substack and follow me. Please, it means a great deal to me. You can follow me for free, but if you pay, that's even better. So anyway, let's get into the show. We've got an amazing guest tonight. It is, of course, Morgoth. Morgoth is one of the great British minds of our time. He is a hero of our people and a tireless worker for our cause. He is massive over on Substack. He is somebody that I have worked with for years. I really enjoy working with, and he puts out what I would say are the best written articles that anyone puts out in the UK. I don't think anyone does it better than Morgoth in the UK, and his Substack is an absolute must. So please support him there too. He's also been a great video content creator, and he's wonderful on live streams. And we're very lucky to have him on sort of two or three times a year. I'm always so thankful when he agrees to come on, because he brings a lot. And this is a perfect time of the year to have him on, because the political turmoil here in Britain at the moment is just completely out of control. So getting his takes tonight will be wonderful. Morgoth, how are you doing? I hope you're well. Tell us what you've been up to since we last spoke.
I'm doing very well, and I'm busy on Substack. Thanks for that nice introduction. My last major article was Revolutionary Straits, where I took a look at Iran as a revolutionary state and kind of compared it to nationalist politics, looking at it from the perspective that Iran is a nationalist state that won't buckle on its principles, which I found quite interesting. No matter how much pain is inflicted on the country, they'll take it for their principles, which I can quite sympathize with, to be honest. But I've been watching the sort of the chaos and the trauma of the elections and the fallout and the twists and the turns, and I just learned before Keir Starmer has admitted in Parliament that he's a gooner, which sounds gentler. This is like a term that the kids say these days. It used to sound harsher when we used to say it back in the day, our version of that. But he's just cringe all over, but he won't flush away. It's really amazing.
Well, there's a couple of things there I want to speak to you about, but obviously we're going to do a lot about Starmer. So I just wanted to talk to you briefly about your new article, just because I find Iran to be an incredible country. Now, being brought up on sort of films like Star Wars as a youngster, you kind of grew up being told that it was sort of a noble thing to support the underdog, to support the small rebel faction against the giant imperial force that seemed overwhelming. And really, if there's an example of that playing out in the real world, it is Iran versus the United States. There you have this massive empire, which largely exists because it has this unstoppable and unbelievably well-funded war machine, and that is bombarding Iran, all at the behest of this evil clique that controls the mighty empire from the shadows. But Iran is standing firm. The people are standing firm. They're getting behind their leaders. They're not giving in. They're fighting back. They refuse to lower their banners and to give up on their ideals. I think Iran could emerge from this, not just as the winners, but almost as a global example to other regimes that you can stand up to the US.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's going to be a regional hegemon. I think they're never going to let those Straits of Hormuz go. In the article, what I was interested in was taking a look at the damage and the sanctions which has been inflicted on Iran over the years, and the idea that at any point they could have bent the knee to Israel and America, and they just didn't. And you begin to realize that it wasn't really about the right to have nuclear weapons. It was the right to be a sovereign nation with their own laws and their own ways, and to be left alone in that way from America and Israel. And it reminded me of arguments that you'll see being used against nationalists in our country on things like it's purely theoretical for now, but this idea that, for example, if you began to deport lots of people, the economy would crash because of the way the debt's funded and all the rest of it, because you would have too many old people compared to young people, and all these arguments. And a lot of the time, sort of people on our side of things will look for a way to argue back against that. They'll say that, well, if you look at who's claiming the benefits and how much that costs and all the rest of it. And I thought, but the fact is, like, you would actually have trouble with the amount of debt we're in if there wasn't a constant inflow of people. And it's kind of like the answer has to be that we don't care. We are willing to go there. We are willing to take the economic hit for the principle that we want our own country. And you get into what I argued is that you begin to get into territory which is actually revolutionary, because you're ending up just brushing aside the prevailing dominant orthodoxy of the day, because you're switching out the first principles. The first principles are no longer we have to keep the economy growing, for example, under an economic model based on endless growth. You get rid of that as a first principle, which is what sort of the neoliberalism is. And instead you put, we are a people and we have our right to our own country. This then gets placed in the center. This becomes the first principle. And sort of philosophically and ideologically, that is revolutionary. And you can look at it, sort of look at Iran and the way they approach these things, because that's pretty much what they have said. And when there is this kind of escalation against them, there's two things that happens there. They're willing to take the pain. They're willing to be sanctioned, have inflation, which is exactly what's happening now. And they're like, okay, do it. Keep doing it. Keep dishing out the pain. We will take it. And then there's a kind of weird thing that happens where it's possible that you begin to escalate from your own perspective, which actually begins to damage the wider system, which is exactly what Iran has done. So you could get into some kind of crazy scenarios where if they became too much, you could say, well, we're going to block off the English Channel unless all of this begins to... And you get into a wider kind of complete fracturing of the globalist model, which I think is what's happening now. To the degree, which I kind of wrapped up the article with, where Iran is through these choking all of this oil, and then it has ramifications with fertilizers and plastics and everything else, you begin to see that they are actually emerging as a threat to the system which has punished them for so long. And another thing is what it tells you is that in this world, nationalism is actually the future. That is what is emerging in the New World Order rather than the endless supply chains and all of this. Because, you know, you would have to source your own food. You would have to have your own energy supplies, which are secure. And it would have to be the government and the state that took care of that. So because your first principle is your people and not the growth of corporations. And so I think it's interesting because everybody gets used to thinking of Iran just in terms of mad mullahs and Islam and all the rest of it. But you can look at it as a nationalist state who held its own ground and is emerging the winner in it.
Indeed. And I think as well, it sort of goes to show that there's more to a state than just money and wealth. Because I'm sure that if Trump went there and had said to these people, put his hand on their shoulders and said, look, to avoid this, if you do what we say, we will give you anything you want, whether it's women, money, you name it, you can have it. Whatever desire is in your heart, we can provide. And that's the power these people have. Anything that they wanted, they could have been given if they had just gone along with Israel and America. All you have to do is get on your knees, lower your head, kiss the hand and say that you agree and that you'll toe the line. And your leaders will be given everything. And it's quite an easy way out for people, isn't it? If you're the leader of a nation and you're presented with, look, all you have to do is go along with what we want and we will look after you and give you everything. Or alternatively, we're going to assassinate you. We're going to bomb your nation. We're going to reduce your capital city to ash and you will get nothing. So for a nation to actually turn around and say, well, we're not kissing the ring. We're not getting down and bowing. We're not scraping on the floor and doing what you say for anything, because anything you can give us is not as important as our own sovereignty. That's a major statement to make, isn't it? To say that, you know, life without sovereignty is pointless is actually the most powerful statement in support of nationalism you can make.
Yeah, it's a Faustian bargain where, yeah, you can get all of the goodies. And even sort of consumer items flooding in, even some of the upper class may be happy. They could go on holiday to Florida and hang out with all of the influencers and all of this. And they've said, no, we won't do it. And we don't care if you tank our currency and we've got hyperinflation, or if we have to slide in pharmaceuticals like through the back door from China, and everything is a chore, everything is a pain, everything is made difficult, and we're going to endure it because some things are worth more than being a prostitute for America and Israel. And just to have that stance, just to have doggedly the stance that we are a sovereign nation and we won't bow, look at what they've had to do. They had to turn, I mean, I saw a very good Nick Fuentes monologue on this, where it's basically, they've had to turn this massive country into a fortress, where you've got all of these cities under mountains. You've got all of these, the way that the power structure has been decentralized. The leadership has to be seven layers deep because everybody's being assassinated all of the time. They're just constantly, if it was a strategy game, they would be in turtle mode for 40 years. All these missiles poking out of every hill and rock just to be left alone, because these people just will not stop if you are a sovereign nation who wants to protect your people. And it shows the world that it can be done. And I do think there's a wider sort of discussion when you bring in kind of third worldism and this kind of thing, because it's like, do we actually want to be just a sovereign nation, or do we want to be part of this wider kind of Western civilization? And there's a lot of debates about that. And I'm certainly not a third worldist, but I do see the dichotomy there.
Well, look, this is one of the stupid things. If you are a genuine nationalist, and a genuine nationalist is someone who wants the best for their own people, but also wants other people around the world to have that right too. So, for example, I want England for the English, but I have no problem with Iranians wanting Iran for themselves. There's always some idiot in the comment section who accuses you of being a third worldist just because you don't want, you know, every other person across the world annihilated in some kind of, you know, bizarre war where white people just decide to push the button and bomb, you know, everyone in the Middle East, everyone in Africa, and everyone on the Indian subcontinent. I think that's just fantasy world stuff. It's never going to happen. People would never stand for it. It would be seen as just completely immoral. And I do believe that nationalism as a framework, as an ideology, is a moral framework, because it extends the same rights to everyone, gives everyone a right to exist, but just states that our existence should be geographically separated.
Yeah, I agree.
But let's get on to the big issue of the day, because obviously you were brought up in a white working class Labour area. I live in a white working class Labour area. And in these areas, we are now, well, in Labour areas, whether they're white working class or whether they are ethnic minority, Labour voters are now voting for Reform or the Greens. I think the only people still supporting Labour are people who are just diehard generational voters and your sort of white liberal activist class who believe in the system. You know, they're liberals, but they believe in the system. So rather than going green or for another party, they want to hold on to that sort of white liberal Labour Party centrist slop. And we saw Labour lose an unbelievable number of seats. I think it was over 1,400 seats at the last round of elections. Now, at any point, that would be bad. But when you also marry it with the results in Scotland and the results in Wales, this has turned out to be the worst electoral defeat ever inflicted upon the Labour Party, which is incredible. And you'd think at this point, the leader of a party would say, hey, it's time. I'm calling it a day. I've led you to utter disaster. You know, like the manager of a football team. Manager of a football team, when things are going badly, when he leads the team to a crushing defeat and to relegation, says, sorry, I've let you down, and walks away. But Starmer doesn't seem to have any shame, does he? I mean, this is two electoral defeats he's led them to. Last year it was bad. Reform won last year. This year it's worse. Reform have won again. But Starmer is holding on, despite losing England, Wales and Scotland. I mean, obviously, to be fair, Scotland had already been lost to the SNP, but he's come out of these elections adding Wales and England to the list of nations that now no longer favours the Labour Party. Why do you think he's clinging on? And what do you think of his behaviour? Because I find it absolutely bizarre.
I mean, I'm actually a bit baffled by it, because if you'd asked me this a year ago, I would probably have said that Starmer's going to cling on because the digital IDs are coming in, which, you know, that's all down to him. That was he announced that just out of the blue. But the thing is that he's so unpopular with everybody, whether on the left or the right, that Farage is probably going to come in. Reform have got a good chance of coming in, and they've pledged to scrap the digital ID. And so you think, well, if he's going to die on this hill, he can go to all this trouble to bring this stuff in. But, I mean, you know, this is assuming that Farage keeps his promise on that. Because I think that Farage has got associations with Palantir and all of that I don't like. But just on the surface of it, it doesn't seem that the digital ID is enough to kind of dig on. Like it, because I think we mentioned this the last time as well. It's as if he's been given a job to do that he has to carry out, which we're not really certain of, and we don't even know if that is the case. But it's as if he has to do something no matter what, no matter how unpopular he gets, no matter how many MPs reject him or how humiliated he gets, or, for that matter, the future of the Labour Party. You get the sense that this is a man on a mission, and he's just not going to stop. He's not going to quit because something has to be done. Now, if that is the case, that's just how it looks. But I actually don't know what it could be. Because, you know, if he was more of a kind of Blairite Zionist, you could say, well, it's all about the war in Iran, it's about Israel and Netanyahu and that great Israel and all of that. But he strangely kind of, in geopolitical terms and foreign policy, he doesn't seem to give much interest to that. He kind of snubs Trump. He doesn't seem to care if Trump likes him. He just doesn't seem to care if anybody likes him. I mean, domestically, it's a different thing because they have to contain all of these protests and whatnot, which maybe we can get onto. But it looks like he's a man on a mission with some kind of higher goal, which is as yet unclear. Or another way to look at it is that he is just this kind of autistic psychopath. He literally is just, as a personality type, he is like the Terminator. There's something not quite right there. But what he's become is this kind of indestructible managerialist bureaucrat who knows every little lever and every button to push to kind of undermine his opponents and remain in power. To do what? Like, what is the purpose of all of this? It's really strange. And but what's happened as well because of this is that he's become a kind of cult meme on the right, where you've got like esoteric Starmerism about how much of a Chad he is because he just doesn't care. Which I find quite amusing, to be honest, because it's rare that we get somebody like this. If you compare him to these Tory types where they get stabbed in the back and then they just step down straight away, he's not like that. He's cut from a different cloth. And it's unusual for us to see this in our politics. Like I say, we're used to like the Tories kind of stabbing each other in the back and then they step down and then you get another one and then it happens again. But Starmer's like, no, he said the other day he could be there until like 2039. We're like, he's just nuts. Or he's a man on a mission. And I honestly don't know which it is.
Well, the funny thing is, we were talking about this before we went live, and I sort of made an analogy that sometimes, you know, you're out with your friends and there's one guy who's making a bit of a tit of himself. There's a guy that's sort of had too much to drink and he's making a fool of himself. He thinks his dancing's great. He thinks his jokes are on point. You know, he thinks he's making the wittiest quips to all the women. In fact, he thinks he's basically James Bond. He's had too much to drink and he's James Bond. Now, the good thing to do if you're a friend is go up to that guy and sort of pull him to one side politely and be like, look, mate, I think you've had one too many. Best to bow out now, grab a taxi home, before you end up making a fool of yourself, or more of a fool of yourself, or do something that, you know, is not going to be so easily written off in the morning as just the actions of a guy that had a bit too much to drink. You know, reel it in. And at that point, most people will be like, oh God, all my mates are telling me it, I better go home. And Starmer's a bit in like that position. Everyone's gone and visited him. All through today, we've been, you know, the unions have warned him. Wes Streeting went in for a meeting to discuss the future of Starmer's premiership. He left in 16 minutes and was kicked out. And you're like, what? So everyone's going to him and going, look, mate, we've been friends for a long time. You know, we were all behind you when we got elected. We've worked as a team. But, you know, for the good of the group, for the good of the gang, for the good of the party, it's time for you to go, mate. It's time for you to jump in the taxi and get gone, because you're making an absolute fool of yourself. And it's starting to reflect on us as well now. And if this goes on too far, you know, the whole party, the thing that you are the head of, is going to be sunk. But he's not listening. He's like, no, I'm getting back out on that dance floor. I'm going to remove another item of clothes. I'm dancing till 3 a.m. The birds are going to love it. You know, everyone's going to be watching, and it's going to look great on social media tomorrow. And everyone's like, no, it's got to stop. It's got to stop. But he's still going for it. And I'm at a loss, because like you, I'm wondering, is there some kind of mental block where it just doesn't faze him? Or has he been told you are in to deliver on a particular piece of policy, just like you're in the CPS to make sure that top-tier establishment sex offenders didn't get put on trial? Yeah, that's what he was there for. He was there to do the establishment a solid and make sure Jimmy Savile didn't go on trial. You know, yeah. What's he there for?
Yeah, this is the thing. Like, he's absolutely an establishment man. He's a system man through and through, straight out of law. But yet he's managed to alienate. I mean, he's not woke enough for the race communists who think he sounds like Enoch Powell on immigration. He's hated by the British patriots because of the Southport, the way he handled Southport, which was a disgrace, and anti-white. The Zionist camp think he's too soft on the race communists and the pro-Palestinian people, so they kind of hint that he's an anti-Semite. The neocons don't like him because he won't go to war. The farmers hate him because of the tax on inheritance. Old people hate him because they're freezing to death in their homes. It's just like he doesn't have any constituency. It's not like he's waltzing in there and he's got all of the woke left behind him. He's got nothing and nobody. There's just like a sort of cabal of people that he's brought in who he can just say, well, it's, you know, if you don't like me, you're out. So he's just got absolutely nobody. He's everybody hates him for their own reasons. He's alienated every faction in the entire political discourse, and yet he just keeps plowing on regardless. It's I've never seen anything like it.
And I've got to say this, because look, you hate the Tories, don't you, mate?
Yeah, despise them.
Yeah, and I do too. And I would argue that I hate the Tories I hate the upper echelons of the Tories more than I hate the upper echelons of Labour. And very kindly, Morgoth actually reposted one of my Substacks about Jacob Rees-Mogg and how he's actually an anti-white replacement fanatic. So thank you for that. You can check that out if you go over to my Substack. But the issue is, I will say this for the Tories, they tend to be slightly more noble in terms of their affinity to their own party and their own cause than Labour. So when somebody like Boris Johnson gets pulled up for what, in all seriousness, was a nothing, you know, a few people were in his office doing a job, working one day, and they brought in a birthday cake and a couple of bottles of, you know, fizzy drinks and cut him a slice of cake because it was his birthday. And that was this giant scandal. And I remember Keir Starmer actually tweeting him saying, the party's over, Boris. It's time to resign. He thought it was a really clever thing. The party's over, you know, because he had his little birthday party during COVID and it caused that big stink. But Boris Johnson turned round and was like, look, I've been savaged by the papers. My own people are turning against me. Do I need this? I can probably go now, make millions of pounds on the speaking circuit, have a cushy job writing for the Telegraph and the Daily Mail. Who cares? And off he went. You know, he's got his prime minister's pension, got all the rest. But he had that sort of, and I hate Boris Johnson. I despise Boris Johnson more than any other post-war politician, I think. But he had that sliver of decency. And one thing about Starmer is he doesn't even have that, does he? He doesn't, you know, the Tories are absolutely despicable vermin. But when it comes to an issue of one of them potentially sinking the party, they have that sliver of decency for their own political party where they will stand aside to stop the ship going down. But Starmer doesn't even have that. He's like, if I'm going down, the ship's going down with me. And look, I love this. Don't think I'm complaining. I want the guy to be the ultimate scumbag because I want Labour and the Tories to go down. That's why I'm sort of more forgiving of reform than most people, because I want to see reform and the Greens wipe out both Labour and the Tories. And I really do want to see Starmer crash the bus so it is irreparable. But I just don't understand why he's doing it. Because if it was an issue of something like digital ID, I can't imagine anybody within the Labour Party taking over and not making good on the Starmer promises. Can you?
Yeah, I think everybody would just carry on with it as it is. I think the digital ID was baked in even before Starmer came. But you're right about the Tories as well, because I think it's what makes the Tories so difficult to get rid of, because they are, I think, they're like the oldest political party in the world. And you know, I'm not the first to compare them to the T-1000 off Terminator 2, where you freeze him and he goes solid, and then you hit him with a grenade and then he shatters all over the place. And then it just starts to sort of reform and bring itself back together and come for you again. You can say that you could even say there's elements of this where they've just kind of molded themselves into reform. But with Labour and Starmer, you don't have any of that. It just seems to be out of control. And it will destroy the Labour Party. They will go down. I mean, even the idea that they're being flanked to their left by the Greens means they're in this sort of situation where, on the one hand, they have to appeal to the white working class. This is an old problem. Well, it's kind of old. I think the emergence of the Greens, I think the Greens are basically there so they don't get another Corbyn-type figure to the left of Labour, who's a bit more of a loose cannon, a bit more anti-establishment than what they are now. But as it stands now, they don't have a constituency and they seem locked on rails heading into the abyss when eventually they have to call a general election. I cannot understand the reasoning or the logic to it at all. Because some of the things they did with, like, on immigration and stuff, people dispute this, but the figures released say that immigration is actually coming down quite a bit from Tory eyes. And then you've got things like people won't have the knock at the door for tweets anymore, non-crime hate incidents. So in a certain way, they're definitely leaning in to policies and kind of frustrations of the patriot base, that we, what I would call the white native population who are, say, reform voters. They're trying to lean into that. And then they've still got the Greens and the woke left to their left who hate all of that stuff. So what I'm getting at is that they are in a difficult position, but he's just done nothing to kind of come up with a clever strategy to any of this. Maybe it is just frustration with, we're locked in for until, maybe the idea is something will turn up. So some kind of crisis will happen, or there's going to be some kind of change, and we'll work it, and we'll be more popular in a few years, which I think is pure quote, to be honest. But that is another theory that you could have on this. So you've got, like, is he a man on a mission? Is he insane? Is he just kind of peddling water until something else comes up? Is another one.
Well, it is interesting. And I do hear what you're saying, because the figures have come down on immigration. Now, they came down and then they revised them back up, which was interesting. And it's the legal figures on immigration that have come down, not the illegal figures. They've increased. But also, the way the government calculates the figures is quite interesting, because they give an estimate. I don't know if you know this, but this is sort of for anyone who doesn't. The government grants visas, but one visa is for sometimes a single applicant, sometimes for a couple, sometimes it's a family visa. And when the government knows exactly how many visas have been granted, but estimates the immigration based on that, as they don't seem to keep figures for how many come in on the family visas. And that's quite interesting. So when the Tories were in power, and there was the Boris wave, they made initial estimates of immigration being around net immigration being around 700,000. Then it got revised up and up and up to over 900,000, which was just incredible. Now Labour have given their figures and they've had to revise theirs up. So initially they said it was about 250,000 legal. But then they revised it up to about 400,000 to 450,000. And then you add the increased illegals on. So you're still talking kind of 500,000 people plus a year, which is still sort of swamping. And I think this is one of the big problems. The Tories sprinted so far down the road with immigration that any pullback seems like a good thing, but still leaves you in a bad position. So, for example, Blair took net migration to a high of 250,000, which at the time was seen as unprecedented, because net migration had only been in the tens of thousands pre-Blair. The Conservatives then took it to 900,000, which is obviously a massive 650,000 increase on the Blair regime. But now, let's say Labour have pulled net migration back to half of that at about 450,000. It sounds good, doesn't it? Labour have halved net migration. But when net migration was so high, halving it isn't good enough. But it is a win from a propaganda point of view. But interestingly, I don't think that's feeding through to the public. I don't think Labour voters are saying, well, we really like the fact Labour have halved net migration. They're just like, we're done. We're done with them. And I think it was Southport and the response to Southport that has irreparably burnt bridges with a lot of white communities. That's not going to be erased. But my sort of feeling on Starmer goes a little bit deeper, because I see Starmer as quite a centrist establishment man with a streak of authoritarianism. So he will go on TV and say, convene the political courts. You know, it's time to get people in jail. This is what we've got to do. And he does that in quite a shameless manner. But he has been relatively centrist, or more centrist, on immigration than the Tories that preceded him. Now, the interesting thing is, who would replace him? And when you're looking at people like Angela Rayner and Andy Burnham, and you do have a significant hard left to the Labour Party that would follow Angela Rayner, do you think they could get rid of Starmer? Because I do. I think they could get rid of him and actually install someone who would speed run the destruction of the party at an even more rapid rate. I can see them letting somebody like Rayner in and it being an absolute catastrophe.
I heard a take yesterday. It's funny, because I should have thought of this earlier, but I heard a take yesterday that if somebody like Rayner or Lammy goes in, the debt will just go crazy. The bond markets will just have a heart attack, and interest rates will go through the roof. They'll just say, no, we can't have this. And the, and I believe it, to be honest. So it is, it is like sort of elite, whatever you think of Starmer, you can say, okay, he's this boring. I think what they wanted was this boring, which they got, this boring technocrat who was at least competent or presented as competent. And that's what we want. This is what, say, the higher ups in international finance wanted. But the problem that they've got is, if you look at the Labour Party more general, it's full of fruitcakes. It's full of lunatics, minorities and sort of identity groups, trans rights activists, because they filled them all up because of the Equality Act, because of the whole DEI woke, George Floyd, BLM, the whole lot of it. That's all sort of baked into the party. And so it's very difficult for them to actually find competent people. If you notice, the people who are all like in the running as the challengers, it's like that Wes Streeting, who's this Blairite Zionist, and then Andy Burnham from Manchester. And they too are these kind of boring sort of white men. Despite it all, somebody somewhere with a lot of clout does not want David Lammy in charge, or Shabama Mahmood, or but I mean, you know, leaving aside the obvious, Shabama Mahmood at least comes across as competent compared to some of the other lunatics that are in the, are running around in the Labour Party. And I think this is a hazard. If you've got $2 trillion in debt, and you get Angela Rayner taking the reins of government, I think you're going to become a laughingstock. Who wants to invest in that country? Who wants to invest in Angela, like with Prime Minister Angela Rayner? I mean, it's funny for the memes, sort of chip shop Debs running, being Prime Minister of the country. But I mean, I've probably mentioned it before, I've got a kind of affinity for Angela Rayner because she's the kind of lass that I grew up with, kind of hanging around in the bus shelter, like giving cheek and jumping in the back of like an Astra GTI. Like I know Angela Rayner's type. I grew up with girls like that, women now, of course. And this is like the sort of chip shop Debs, the big chunky boots that she wears. And it's funny, you know, where she's in the canoe with like a can of Carling Black Label and the vape. And it's just, it's funny to see memes like that on the internet. But by God, you got her as your prime minister. You've got problems. You've got problems because there's people sitting in central banks who are just going to have a heart attack. Where's our money? We're never going to get our money back if she's in charge. So I think there is pressure just to keep Keir Starmer in place, because the economy will go belly up if you've got these nut jobs in the top office. That could be like a really sort of basic point that we've missed.
Mate, you just had me in stitches, but you're so right. Angela Rayner is kind of that sort of buxom, slightly rough, chavvy bird who likes nothing more than, you know, pre-gaming it on a Friday or Saturday night with the Lambrini, going out, getting hammered. And at the end of the night, she's the kind of woman that is parading down the street in a scandalously tight and short, shiny leather skirt, cackling at the top of her voice, kebab balanced in one hand, phone in the other, taking a selfie or video calling a bloke she fancies. And these sort of women, like you call it chip shop Debs, they're everywhere in sort of white working class areas. And look, some of them are nice people, and you can have a laugh with them when you're down the pub, and you have a chat with them when they're in the park with their kids and you're there with your kids. But putting them in charge of the country is just sort of a frightening thought, really. And I'm all for power to the people, but she is the kind of person that you wouldn't want in charge. And it's not just because she is that kind of, you know, chip shop Debs, low IQ woman. But that particular archetype, I tend to find when you're getting on well with them, they're actually quite a laugh. They're down to earth. They're quite a laugh. You can have fun with them. But my Lord, if you cross that kind of woman the sort of bitchiness, the venom that comes from them is sort of unparalleled. And you can imagine her being in a position of power, and she'd almost be like the Queen of Hearts from Alice in Wonderland. She'd be lining people up to have their heads chopped. I can imagine she would be so shameless with the sort of feminist agenda, with the anti-racist stuff. I think she would be, I mean, they call her the Red Queen, don't they? I think she would be the worst. And I'm not sure if I want that or if I don't want that. Because on one hand, it would increase my chances of probably going to jail exponentially. But at the same time, the ride would be kind of fantastical, wouldn't it? I can imagine doing a show with you and just reviewing a supercut of all of her clips in Parliament. It would be good.
Yeah, it would be amazing. Sometimes I make jokes about on Twitter or whatever, and I'll call her Chip Shop Debs. And people sometimes get pushback, and they're like, "Oh, well, you're no better. Like, you're just from North Tyneside." And it's like, well, that's the whole point. The whole point is that I do have like an affinity with these people. These are my people. I grew up with these people. And that's why I think it's funny to see somebody that I can relate to so much being in this position of government. I find it quite crazy, to be honest. But it isn't this where I have this hatred of that kind of person. Not at all. They're my people. I grew up with them. I'm not gonna push back against any of these people in that sense. But they should not be running the country, especially these days. I mean, and it, by the way, there's been lots of working class people in who've had very high positions in Britain. Tony Blair's government had a lot of people who are kind of still hung over. Like you think somebody like John Prescott, who was this bruiser, who was there straightening people out. Like two Jags. Remember that? Two Jags Prescott. And it's like, so they were there.
The guy who threw an egg at him and thought it was going to be funny, and Prescott just knocked him out.
He was a genuinely tough fella. He was a brawler from like social clubs and all of that. I think he did boxing in his younger days.
Threw the egg, started laughing. And before he'd finished laughing, Prescott had smacked him in the face and his head snapped back and the laugh was off his face. But that, just...
Seasoned brawler. And the point is, like, yeah, great, fine, that's fair enough. Because you tend to find that they would be kind of these kind of George Galloway types as well. They would have been in the unions on the streets in these hard towns, and they would have had a bit of theory as well. So it's not about that. There's a long tradition of that in this country, but there's limits when it comes to somebody like Angela Rayner. Let's be real here.
Do you know how I see Prescott? I can see John Prescott in a unitard climbing in to a wrestling ring on ITV's World of Sport on a Saturday afternoon. And all the grannies like cheering, like, it's Jabba John from the Northeast. Look, he's going to give him it. And he does a little dance around the ring and everyone's going wild. There he is. And, you know, you can imagine his gimmick being brought up to the ring in one of his Jags, you know. And that is the kind of guy he is. But again, if you've lived in these areas, which we both have, those are the kind of fellas that you do meet. And I'm not against them taking power into their own hands in the local area and having a say in legislation. But sometimes you do need almost somewhat of an officer class, if you like, to actually have their finger on the button. And I think Angela Rayner would be a crazy ride. But I'm somebody who does quite enjoy a little bit of accelerationism here and there. And I think she would be another accelerationist candidate. And I wouldn't be surprised if the reason Starmer had been told to stay on was because this was a way to try and remain with Labour as a centrist party. And somebody said, look, we need centrist Labour, we need centrist Tory, we need those two parties to emerge from this as still the two biggest parties. We need to ride this bump, and we don't need Labour and the Tories to play into this further polarisation of British society, which is, you know, that's where we are now, aren't we? We are in the era of polarisation. We're in the era of, you know, mums at the school gates in some areas saying they'll never vote Labour, they're voting Reform, and in other areas saying, yeah, we're never voting Labour again, we're voting Greens. We're in this era of, we're going in different directions, there's irreconcilable differences, society's not going to fix itself. And Angela Rayner, she could actually end up pushing it further down that route, and that's not what the establishment want.
Yeah, in the end, the people will disagree with this, but I think in the end, what the establishment really wants is stability. They don't want shocks from the far right. They don't want shocks from the far left. They'll lean a little bit this way or that, but it is quite difficult for them at the moment. And I think it's fair to say that Angela Rayner will be a shock to the system. And we may find, I mean, I've never looked into it closely, but it could be that what you find is that because you've got all of these people checking out, that Starmer is actually scouting like a cadre of people who are like boring centrists like him, just like pure law technocrat types, just to do everything by the book and nothing beyond that. No fancy ideologies or we're going to do this, which is extreme, and we're going to do that. Everything just by the book and boring is what they want, I think, because instability is dangerous for any regime. And that's why I tend to think what the establishment wants is stability at the end of the day.
I think that as well. And I think Badenoch and Starmer bring that. Starmer's obviously married to a Jewess. Badenoch, she is an ultra-Zionist. Both of them represent very, very multicultural families. They present the face of a modern multicultural Britain. You know, Starmer is former head of the CPS, as I said, married to a Jewish woman, bringing the children up Jewish. Badenoch, she's obviously African. You know, she represents replacement migration. Both of them are the ultimate centrist leaders, and they're both there to play their role. But I think if Starmer, you see, I don't think the Tories will ever move away from centrism. I think the Tories know where they are. Their activist base has largely gone to Reform. They're not going anywhere now. They're going to sit in that centrist spot and hope that people say, I'd rather vote for the Tories just because I want to take it back to the 1980s when things were good. I think that's what they're hoping for. But Labour, and we saw this with Corbyn, has a genuine chance of shifting to a position that I think those in charge of the establishment actually fear. And I think that's why they want Starmer there, because we've got to face it. And what do you think to this, Morgoth? This is an important point. Starmer got in with fewer votes than Corbyn got in the previous general election. So Corbyn actually was more popular in terms of raw number of votes than Starmer. So you can actually see that when it comes down to it, there is actually a desire within the Labour Party for a more radical, potentially anti-Zionist, potentially radically pro-immigration party. That's what Corbyn offered. And people said he was the worst thing that happened to the Labour Party, that he led it to ruin. But in fact, he got more votes than Starmer.
Yeah, I think everything to do with Corbyn was an establishment. Well, I think he was hung out to dry by the Zionists. I think it was non-stop attacks because they feared the ramifications. They knew what they had to get done in the coming years, which we're in now, and the very last thing they wanted was to have somebody like Corbyn in there who would be a nightmare for them. And I actually think, I mean, it sounds a little bit conspiratorial, but I think Zach Polanski is there because he'll lean into that anti-Zionism. He'll kind of say that the Palestinians are being treated horribly and all of the rest of it. But the thing is, he's Jewish. And I think when you've got somebody like Corbyn in who isn't, the anti-Zionism on the left, it kind of comes very close to what the mainstream would think of as anti-Semitism. And it, especially since in the last couple of years, this has really blown up. Like, if you see things like Anna Kasparian will say things that we wouldn't say. Or she'll reply to somebody on Twitter and tell them to shut the F up. The guy, you are awake now, was a thing that you can't. So you see all these things. And I think there's a danger that they need to have a hard block on the left against that sort of anti-Zionist sentiment spreading too far and getting a little bit out of hand, where, because it's convenient if they say, well, it's Zionism, that's one thing, this is an ideology, and non-Jewish people can be Zionists, this is what they'll say. But then there's a kind of, you can add in very easily slip into territory where it's becoming closer and closer to just the Jews. And I've heard people like John Mearsheim say what he's sort of sees coming is where people are going to look at the Iran war, the anti-Zionist sentiment as it stands now is going to very quickly sort of converge into the Jews tricked us into a war. I mean, this is not what, you know, this isn't my take. This is what mainstream influential people are saying is a possibility. But when you've got Zach Polanski there, who's Jewish, it kind of keeps that contained, because if he's the leader of your party, you're always going to have a block on going too far in that direction, especially when he's saying all the right things. And I think this is kind of what's been taking place on the left. This is where we are now. And from the perspective of the whole Iran war and all of that, this is probably why we didn't end up going to war, is because they're looking at the numbers and they're thinking, well, none of our base is supporting this. And that's not even to mention the problems that you could have with Muslims within the country, rioting or Labour's a big mess, and a bigger mess than the Tories. But I mean, that's a whole different thing, which I could get into as well. But that's generally the sort of a Zionist angle, because it seems like, well, we're not talking about immigration on any of this. But that's because the people who are talking about don't seem to care at all.
I think it's interesting what you say, and I see it slightly differently. I think that they know there's this big anti-Zionist push, and they're very aware of that. And they're also aware that people like Anna Kasparian, people like Tucker Carlson and several others are starting to sort of blur that line between, well, it's, you know, anti-Zionist, and, you know, some are starting to say, well, actually, it's Jewish power. They're saying, and the two things are slightly different. You know, there is Jewish power and there is Zionist power, but they are becoming blurred. And we have to face it, the majority of Jews do seem to support, especially the majority of powerful Jews do seem to support the State of Israel. And then there is the hypocrisy, like the British Board of Deputies supporting the State of Israel, but not supporting an ethnic homeland for the English, the Scottish or the Welsh. And this is becoming more and more noticeable. But I think they're slightly more comfortable with that line being pushed by the Green Party than they would have been with that line being pushed by Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party, and what is ostensibly, you know, a century plus aged political party that is embedded on a national level and is one of the two central pillars of British politics. And I've tried to explain this to people, because a lot of people say, well, look, Mark, what if Reform get in? They're just going to be Tories 2.0. It's just going to be a changing of the badge and you'll end up with the same thing. But you don't. That's not true. It's impossible. You cannot replace a political party that is hundreds of years old with a new party and transfer generational voting patterns, transfer generational wealth, and transfer the 100 years plus of infrastructure that they've built up to this separate organization. It doesn't happen like that. Labour have the labour clubs. They have the unions. They have the local associations. Where I live in Wakefield, there's a building called the Red Shed. It is literally a shed in the city centre that is red coloured, and it's the local labour club. It's where the labour members go for a drink. You know, if somebody takes over from the Labour Party, they wouldn't benefit from all of those things. But imagine if the major anti-Zionist leftist force was the Labour Party. That would be far worse from the establishment's point of view, because you do get not only the anti-Zionism, but you get the generational voters, you get the generational infrastructure, the wealth, the clubs, the networks, the unions, all falling into line. That for them, I think, would be a lot scarier. And as I said, I don't think they have that with the problem with They don't have that problem with the Tories. I don't think the Tories could ever go any more radical. And that's why they're kind of like completely lost at the moment. They don't really know what they're doing. But Labour have proved they can be steered to a radical position that certain quarters of the establishment, like the British Board of Deputies, would absolutely fear. Can you imagine now if Corbyn was leader of the Labour Party and was prime minister? Well, there probably would be sanctions on Israel. You know, the Labour friends of Israel would be, you know, on the back foot. Things would be different. But Starmer does at least present a hard block to Labour being co-opted by people who actually represent their activist base, because I think Labour's activist base is largely anti-Israel.
Yeah, I completely agree with what you're saying. I think it's a good point, because it really, it's the institution that matters. And it's a bit like, it's a bit like, you know, we all know the BBC is woke and it's anti-white and all the rest of it. But as an old institution, it still carries something which Amazon Prime doesn't, or one of these new streaming services. They just don't have that sort of institutional weight and history with them. And so when you have a kind of a new insurgent party like the Green Party, who are more critical, it doesn't have the same gravitas that it does when it's the Labour Party doing it. I think you're right on that. Absolutely.
And this is actually why I keep doubling down and saying that even if it is reform that destroys the Tories, what they destroy can never be replicated, because it would take hundreds of years to replicate it. And I explained this on a stream, I think it was the other week, where when I said about the BNP, when the BNP was destroyed, there was lots of successor organisations, but none of them had the resources that the BNP had built up since the early 80s. Those resources were just lost, disappeared, they were gone, couldn't be replicated. And I think that's an important thing to remember. And I do believe that they don't want Labour falling into those hands. And the interesting thing is with the Greens are only doing well at the expense of Labour, which does mean that if Labour, say they invited Corbyn back tomorrow and Corbyn was given the leadership of the Labour Party, and all of a sudden he started making addresses to the nation about combating Zionism, calling Zionism a racist endeavor, saying that Israel doesn't unequivocally have the right to exist when it's committing genocide. My God, the Greens would fold overnight and just roll into the Labour Party, wouldn't they? I think he would unite the entire left under an extremely interesting banner that also benefited from tens of millions of pounds of union workers' dues, generational voters, and that structure of local labour clubs. You could actually see a position where, at that point, the anti-Zionist machine taking over a centrist force would cause a severe headache for powerful Zionists and Jewish lobbyists. I I think that's probably the issue.
With much, much broader public support than what they had 10 years ago or 2018 with Corbyn, when it was seen as a bit of a side issue. But now, the Middle East, you've actually got war, which many people will think on wherever they are on the political spectrum, except for maybe Tories, is that this is a war for Israel. This is just what everybody is saying. It's not like what it was 10 years ago or like that. So there'd be a massive amount of people willing to say, yeah, this is, he's right. And it's not on. It's not on. And there would be steps to say, we need this influence out of government. It's just not on.
But also, there is a coalition that would be formed there. Corbyn would immediately take the Muslim vote. And this is going to upset people, but it's true. The Muslim vote is one of the most important voting blocks in Britain when it comes to absolute power. Because if you win the Muslim bloc vote, they all come out and vote for you. And you saw how important that was in Gorton and Denton. The Greens reached out to the Pakistani Muslims in the area. They only made up about 20% of the population, but they all turned out to vote, and it made the difference. That was the voting bloc that swung the election. So first, Labour would take that Muslim vote. I think Labour would also take the black and largely the rest of the ethnic minority. Sure, there'd be some who went to other parties. I know it's not monolithic, but I think they would take largely the ethnic minority vote. I think on top of that, they would take the entire progressive, leftist, liberal, woke, whatever you want to call it, white vote. And I think they'd also suck up a lot of the special interest groups. So they would take the LGBTs, the gays, the feminists. All of those groups would follow too. And you would end up with this sort of witch's brew of different ethnic and special interest groups that combined, well, individually would be not that powerful, but combined could win a national election. And add to that the things you've pointed out, sort of like you'd still have your generational Labour voters, etc., and some diehard white working class Labour supporters. That coupled with your union money, I think it would be a force that would not only be pretty much unstoppable at the ballot box, unless white Brits got their act together and stood up as a group. But it would also be something that would scare the people who sit above the politicians. They would start to worry. And I'm not saying, you know, Corbyn's some radical who, you know, would start, you know, collecting Jews up and, you know, deporting them to Israel or anything like that. I think he's some sort of, you know, sort of firebrand, like he's not Stalin Mark II or something, but I do think it would be very, very interesting. And I think they fear that. But look, you have the final word on this, mate, then we'll go to the second half of the show.
I mean, it does, this dilemma, what we're talking about, we've been talking about in terms of the left, but I think it's this is becoming an acute issue on the right, because a lot of people on the right now are also anti-Zionist. I mean, you see this everywhere. So you find yourself kind of nodding in agreement with the likes of Anna Kasparian or these people on this particular issue. And I think that's where things are going. So for years, we've complained about the kind of the counter-jihad stuff, the Tommy rallies and all of that. But that seems all very kind of sad and dated now. And we've done what we could over the years to nudge it in the one direction or another against it. But it's real-world events, actual real-world events, and what could be all kinds of economic problems and supply chain issues coming towards us very soon. And people are going to be sick of this. And then on top of that, there's the whole issue with Trump just blatantly lying to his base and betraying them. And I think the kind of how do we frame that? Because it's complicated for the man in the pub, because he will tend not to be very fond of Muslims. And so he then gravitates towards a position which is a sort of my enemy's enemy is my friend type of thing, which isn't really where we want to be, because it leads you back into that containment zone. And so this has to be for the here and the now, because there's been a lot of discussion about this. Sort of, where is Rupert Lowe on this? We know where Farage is and all the rest of it. And there's been a lot of arguments and a lot of sort of what's happening. What is Restore's take on this? Because these old tweets, it's a little bit vague. Are we going to get a backstab? Which is all perfectly understandable for people to think that way. And the way they handled the Iran war was just neutrality. It's none of our business. We don't want to get involved, which I think is the correct play for the here and now. Now, some people don't like that. They want to have a kind of explicit condemnation of Israel. I think that's probably going to confuse a lot of people. But we are heading towards that kind of politics. Again, not because, like, you know, people are watching Twitter or this. I think this is just oozing through into the real world. And this is the thing of the future. I think increasingly Zionism is going to be a busted flush. It's like they've bet the house on what's happening right now. But they're tenacious and they've came back from things time and time again. But the corruption at the top of the American government is just disgusting and obscene, and even people on the right see it. So this is something that has to be worked out.
I agree. Well, look, that's an excellent way to round that off. Let's do the super chats. Thank you to everyone who super chatted already. If you haven't, Entropy has gone. It's essentially been closed down because a spiteful group of journalists made a documentary about Entropy saying that they were funding hate. It's been closed down, and this has massively affected and impacted a range of different content creators who primarily produce video content, such as myself, Warren Balog, others. It's had a massive effect and it's really hurt us. And we haven't been paid by Entropy for 3 months, which makes things even more difficult. So if you are an Entropy subscriber or you were an Entropy donor, you can help me in two ways. You can either go over to Rumble and Super Chat. That is really helpful because then you can have your Super Chats read out and you can support us that way. Or you can go to my Substack. I've started a Substack. I'm producing 2 articles a week. Some of them are either brand new articles, like the 2 articles this week, both brand new. Others are reworked older articles with about 50% new material. And they're all good. They're all long reads, usually between about 2,500 and 4,000 words. So they're properly, you know, written, sourced and well-considered articles. Please, please help me. I know there's a lot of people who subscribed to me on Entropy. That made up the largest sum of my income every month. And to have that go in one fell swoop, just cut down, really, really affects me. So if you're an Entropy, a subscriber or donor, please do go to Rumble now and do a super chat if you can. Or if you're a long-term viewer and you want to subscribe, please go to my Substack. It's linked in the descriptions. It's also the pinned comment. You can follow me there and support me there. It really is important, if people want to help me, that that's how you do it. Because if you don't, it is going to have a major impact on me, because we haven't been paid for a long time. And we also are in a position where that source of funding is no longer there. Anyway, we'll read out the super chats now. Thank you to all people who've already done it. And if you can do it, I really, really am genuinely thankful. And I know it's a big problem for people to have to go and restart subscriptions and give money in different ways. But unfortunately, if you are a political dissident, this is what you're faced with. Anyway, we'll start with PopsandMe22, who gave $2. Thank you so much. And said, what's your thoughts on Paul Miller? He seems to support white people despite not being completely white himself. This is Gypsy Crusader. I've done a stream or been on a stream with Gypsy Crusader. He's actually a really, really nice guy. I know people see him doing this sort of radical content where he is sort of very much jumping up and down, saying crazy things in Joker makeup, you know, antagonizing people, etc., for clicks and views. But when you actually sort of get beneath the makeup, he's actually a really nice guy, really well spoken. His viewpoints are very well considered. He's very easy to get on with. I enjoyed talking to him and found him really relatable. I would love to actually interview him on a special show and talk to him. I don't know how to get in touch with him. If Paul Miller wants to get in touch with me, get in touch with me via Telegram or via email at mark@thefallofwesternman.com. You know, I'd be happy to work with him. if he wants to come and do something. Anyway, I don't know if you know who Gypsy Crusader is, Morgoth, or if you have an opinion.
No, I don't think so. Is it the lad that wears goth makeup?
He wears Joker makeup from the film Joker, and he goes on sort of these like chat roulette style streams where people come on and talk to him, and he talks to them about race and immigration, and often it's quite a spicy presentation. He's quite a spicy guy, but when you sort of get beneath that, he's actually really nice.
I don't know who that is.
Yeah. So, yeah, he's a nice guy. And if he wants to reach out to me, I'd have him on. The Shogun gave $10. Thank you so much. And he made the very kind comment, the Substack articles are phenomenal. I hail you, sir. And a little man waving. Well, thank you very much. Look, I do put a lot of effort into my Substack and to my streams. And I did with my videos when I was doing them. Substack allows me to double my work output per week. And nothing I do is AI written. This isn't like I put a question into AI and it spits out an essay. Everything I do is me on stream or writing, researched by me, written by me, produced by me. No AI crap. I don't know if you've heard, Morgoth, but interestingly, have you seen this? In China, they've made it illegal to sack any worker and replace them with AI.
Yeah, I think that's great. I can't stand AI. I would absolutely support that law. No problem. I think it's very. It's mainly an American thing, but I'm sort of just browsing on YouTube and things, and you really see a lot of Americans who are horrified about these AI data centers that are going up. And it's not something that's affected us. I don't think we're really in the AI game. So as far as I'm aware, we don't have this. But they're really like people in, like, you'll find that some town in Ohio will suddenly find that their energy costs have gone up by like 120% and their water supply is polluted. And they'll have like this data center has just been plonked there that's five times the size of a football pitch. And it just seems very ominous. I saw something today that NVIDIA now has more money than all of the economies of nations in the world, except America's and China's. And I just think this is, I don't like this. I'm a technophobe, so I don't really like all this stuff at the best times. But when you see this kind of giant digital thing being ruled out, which nobody really voted for, had any say in, I think it's all very ominous. So I absolutely support the Chinese in that.
Yeah, you're right. And I do find all of this, this is sort of a little Mark Collett story, so some people won't like this, but I remember watching the people who made Super Mario Brothers talk about how they created the graphics for the game, and they worked out how many pixels the tiles that made up what you see on the screen were composed of, and how many of those tiles fit into the screen. And the screen is a set number of pixels. I think it was something like 240 by 224 pixels. I think that's correct. If I'm not right on that, I'll probably be quite ashamed of myself, because I should know that being a fan. And they used to draw the graphics on graph paper. So they used to have specially made pieces of graph paper that would be the same size as the screen, with each little square being a pixel. And that's how they designed it. And they would sit there and they draw it all out on graph paper. Then they would give the graph paper to the technical guys, and the technical guys would go and convert what was done on the graph paper into a level. And then within a few hours or the next morning, the guys who designed the level would come in and play it. And they'd be like, oh, that's really good. It plays well. Or this could be better if we did this here. Then they'd redraw it. They'd make little additions and go back to the guys who'd code it and put it in. And I find all that quite charming. A group of sort of dorky guys sat around a table with their graph paper, drawing their little boxy characters and levels. And now you've got people making entire games, making films, making cartoons just with AI prompts. And, you know, I've seen that being used by people like Devin Stack to great effect. He made that wonderful video, I forget the name of it now, which is embarrassing, where the phrase dirt meat came from. It's a really, really, really good video, absolutely fantastic. But I do worry that this kind of, the skills that we used to have, that we worked, how we worked with technology to create great things, are all going to be lost. And all we're going to be left with at the end is just people who can give AI a prompt and that's it. And humans are going to become surplus to requirement. I think that's a worry.
Yeah, I don't. I think it's different if you're doing it for graphics. But I've been blogging for like 12 years now, and I actually like the process of it. I like the turns of phrase, and because at the end of the day, it's about expressing yourself. And so I like to put my own little jokes in there and have like hooks and things. And the idea that I could put a prompt in and then what? I just find that totally warped. Because you're taking away your own agency. I want to create it. I want to sit back and be proud of me thing. The thing is, I don't see like loads of great movies coming out of Hollywood, which is all entirely AI. I was thinking of like something the equivalent of Akira, which came out in 1989, because a lot of the AI stuff that you see is this kind of neon. They seem to like this neon cyberpunk kind of aesthetic. And you think, well, where is that now? Because we're a few years into this. Is it always going to be like these little clip videos? When are we going to get the big AI-only blockbuster? Because I think it should have arrived by now, and it just hasn't, as far as I'm aware. They'll use it for special effects and things, but just the whole AI package movie seems to me should have arrived by now, but it hasn't.
No, you're right, and I've got to stick up. I've got to really sort of like, well, you don't need sticking up for, but I've got to really sort of bolster Morgoth's point here. When Akira came out in 1988, it was groundbreaking because it was the first time an animated movie had been set so heavily at night, to the point where they were basically drawing by hand the neon lights of Tokyo. And it's very, very difficult to draw lights and to sort of produce an animated film where light plays such an integral role. It looks incredible. It looks beautiful. And to this day, it's still a striking work of art. It cost $5.7 million to make. And at the box office, it took $49 million. So it was an extremely successful piece for its time. And it set the bar for that kind of animation. And I still think it hasn't been done better to this day. And I don't think it'll be done better. And I think that's one of the sad things with AI, that it's not actually something, it's something that's actually a block now to humans raising the bar. And I agree with Morgoth. I've got to say this, mate, since I've started doing the Substack, I've only done 11 articles. So it's still quite new to me. I've been doing it 5 weeks, but I've enjoyed doing the articles far more than I thought I would. You don't have the constraints you had on time when you're dealing with a video, because you're not having to record it and do the voiceovers and the graphics. You have this longer time to sort of edit and pore over the words you use. And I think there is a certain art to chaining sentences together so that it's compelling to read them. And I really enjoy doing it. And I think it's something that I don't think AI could just replicate. And you are a real wordsmith. Your writing, as I said at the beginning, is second to none. I would rate you as Britain's best blogger. I'd say the best vlogger, the person who did the best videos, was always Way of the World. He was my favourite vlogger, but you were my favourite blogger. And there is an art to both of those things. But I think that art is lost with AI, and I'm not a big fan of AI. I'm a critic. Anyway, Malibu and Coke gifted 10 subscriptions. Thank you for such generosity. It means a lot. Hazelnut 3000 gave $10 and said thank you to you both. Thank you so much. Scuba Chicken 69 gave $20. Thank you so much. He said, great stream, guys. With Iran, we see religion provide much of the backbone to their nationalism. Are we doomed without God? I fantasize about some solar Gnostic English Mahdi showing the way. Lol. What do you think to that, Morgoth? Because it is interesting. I know that a lot of people are down on Christianity in our movement. But when everybody in the village went to the village church, England was a better place. Do we need some kind of religion to bind us?
I think, yes, I think it absolutely does help. I know I'm well aware of like the criticisms of Christianity, but it didn't stop us from doing things in the past, which would be considered like decidedly un-Christian in our own interest. I think we were at our greatest when we had Christianity. But just sort of leaving that aside, just looking at it objectively, yeah, I think you're better off with religion than not in terms of having a higher ideals and having a kind of a moral center, which is not purely rational. I think that's a good thing. But the way I look at it is that we are where we are. We are creatures of modernity, and so you have to kind of formulate principles which are a bit more raw than that. It becomes quite materialistic, but that it seems to me that is where we are. But maybe there's the kind of talk where there's a second religiousness, which is I think is related to AI, is a factor in this, where the kind of the world that Richard Dawkins wanted is just never happening. It's not coming into be. We aren't all these kind of rational computers, and I think religion does a good job of kind of filling in those holes. But there is a valid criticism of Christianity in its universalist nature. We can't dismiss that entirely. I do take those on board, but just in terms of sort of personal ethics, I think it's a good thing. I do think it's a good thing. I'm kind of an old-fashioned sort of traditional conservative in that regard. Which the modern conservatives aren't very much, but I do tend to see that it does strengthen and embolden society. And I think you'd be better off having it than not. But if you don't, if it is this kind of, if it's withered on the vine, you just have to do with what you've got.
I think it's interesting because there were many people like my parents, you know, their parents met and were married in the local church. They had their children. Their children were christened in the local church. They grew up. They met their wife, their husband. They were married in the local church. And there was that history there. And it was reflected, you know, in the names on the walls. It was reflected on the names and the headstones in the graveyards. And you could see entire families that had grown up in the same area, attended the same church. They were christened there, married there, and laid to rest there. And you felt those people were tied to not only the church, but the land and the village. And it was almost as if the church was the center of the village, where all the threads connected and where everything started with that christening, but also everything ended. And those places were places of joy. They were places of sorrow. They were places that marked the most important, meaningful points in your life. And it's almost as if the left have done everything they can to split people away from that. And when you pull that pin out, which was the church at the center of, you know, traditional English village life, all those threads that ran to it just unravel and disappear, and holding them together again is virtually impossible. And I think when people talk about Christianity in a wholly negative light, I actually wonder if they've ever been to one of these English villages, like the places where my parents grew up in a small village called Heckington. And I still go back there every year, even now with my family, because it's part of our family tradition. We go back there to Heckington, you know, because when I was a kid, when my parents were children, their parents took them to Heckington Show, which is the largest and oldest village show in the whole of England. When we were children, my parents took us back to Heckington, to our grandparents' houses, and we went to that show. Now, I'm a dad. I take my children back there to see my family, and we all gather there once a year. It's the place where the whole family is there. And, you know, when I'm there, I will visit the churchyard and see my grandparents' headstones. And I think that's important. There's going to be people soon who don't know where their parents or grandparents are buried. There's going to be people who won't know where their mum and dad married. They won't have any connection to anything. People will just be like, well, mum and dad died and we emptied the ashes in at a local river and they're gone and it's finished and it's over. Those ties that bound us all did have a religious aspect to them. And I think that it's very easy to be kind of your Richard Dawkins edgy man or these people that hate Christianity because they think it's weakened the West. But I think they overlook a lot of what Christianity did to hold communities together. I think that's important. And I think people who write that off, especially in an obnoxious way, don't truly understand the historical importance of the things that you and I are talking about. I mean, you came from a white working class area. What's your take on it?
Well, I was christened Catholic because of my grandparents. And so I had old ladies coming around to my grandmother's house. And then on the other side, it was Protestant. But the church was there in North Tyneside. There was a small church. Well, there still is. But it was more the Catholic side that dominated me personally, because my grandma was quite influential in that way. And I mean, and I've been back to the church many times more recently. And I think the way to approach this is not to overthink it and over-rationalize it. Like, don't go in as an intellectual and just think of it as a community thing, as Mark was saying. So you don't walk in and be like this kind of cynical postmodern edgelord, and just kind of think, yeah, this is the sort of tradition. This is where I belong, and I'm just going to grit my teeth and go through it. And it's really not that bad. And you kind of go with it. You can kind of think, yeah, I like this. I like this. This feels settled. It's a place which is in some ways outside of modernity, which we're all looking for. And we can get into the weeds on this, because some of you've got like feminists in charge of the Church of England and things now, which is just awful. But just on the face of it, I'm fine. There was a time about 20 years ago when I couldn't wait to deconstruct it, because I had an uncle who would go to the church all the time, and I was reading books by Hitchens and Dawkins. I went through a new atheist phase, and I couldn't wait to go back and talk about sky fairies and all of this. And I just look back at that now and think, God, I just cringe. Like, what a know-it-all arsehole I was being. Like, what was running through my mind? I never actually did. I know nothing happened. But just where I was going to come back as being this cynical know-it-all, it just makes me want to bite the back of my hand with embarrassment at that. And I'm long past having this. I think it's fine. I don't have any kind of opposition to it at all.
I think the thing that made me totally see the kind of Richard Dawkins obnoxious atheism for what it was the fact it was only directed at Christianity. So the mockery was a one-way street, and it was always directed at sort of the village church where my parents were married. You know, that was the place that we were mocking. That was the place we were deconstructing stone by stone, tearing the gargoyles from the walls and smashing them on the ground while laughing. But the same deconstruction was never aimed at Islam. It was never aimed at Buddhism, Hinduism, or, you know, Judaism. You know, Dawkins wasn't going to stand there and deconstruct the Hebrew texts. You know, he wasn't going to deconstruct, you know, the Torah. He wasn't going to start connecting Judaism with the slaughter that goes on in Gaza. You know, now I can tell you this, if white Christians had been rounding up people, especially, you know, quote unquote, brown people, and slaughtering them en masse, Dawkins would probably have been one of the first to condemn that and talk about the evils of religion. But people like Dawkins are usually very, very quiet when it comes to Judaism, the state of Israel, which is intrinsically linked to Judaism, obviously, and its human rights abuses. And at that point, I can't take these people seriously, because you're either tearing down religion and you're targeting all of the quote unquote sky fairies, or you're just attacking Christianity, at which point you're attacking something that was once implicitly white and a central node in white British communities, whilst not extending that attack to ethnic minorities. So by your very action, you weaken white Britons, but you strengthen, comparatively, every ethnic minority living in Britain, because you allow them to keep doing those things, which gives them a sense of purpose, power, and in-group preference.
Just a quick final point on this, if you want to move on. But I notice, like, John Cleese now comes out as being kind of base-coded on Twitter. I think he complains about there's too many immigrants, we're losing the country's identity and all of this. And you know, he with the life of Brian, but just generally, there's been for a long time, and he embodied it when he was a young man, this kind of cynical attitude where everything had to be desacralized. Everything that the older generations held dear had to be dragged through the mud and mocked and made low status and kind of people who believed in anything, not even just Christianity. If you had any firmly held beliefs with the way of life, you were in for it. And this kind of ironic, sort of cynical postmodern attitude, it's brought us to where we are, in my view. But it was about everything which had any kind of state, anything which was outside of the modern world, or was transcendent or metaphysical. Everything was just dragged through the mud. And then in his old age, he's kind of like, oh, what's happened? We've lost our identity. We're overrun with Muslims. Why is there mosques everywhere? And it's because, well, people like you created a void. You created a nothingness, which is now being filled. Not just with Islam, but with like crazy lefty ideas and all kinds of lunacy.
It was very popular at one point. I remember YouTube particularly went through a phase of aggressive atheism. And you had people like The Amazing Atheist and Atheism is Unstoppable. That guy's a completely unsufferable tit, by the way. And I caught him out. I had actually debated him and caught him out, because he is one of the people who will only attack Christianity. But all of those content creators were very, very... Another one, I think he's called Thunderfoot. He's another one, absolute sort of like disheveled mess of a human being, complete freak. He's the guy, you know, had 20 COVID jabs just to prove it was safe, you know, and now dribbles uncontrollably. And these people were the big cheeses on YouTube at one time. They were there was this massive atheist movement, but again, always targeted Christianity and never targeted other communities. Point gave $25 and said, donation, thank you for your continued support. Baron Dorothian gave $10. Thank you so much. And said, happily subscribe to you on Substack. Why did you start recently? How do you get around the blanket ban directed against you online? Also sub to Morgoth and Woes. Been watching you fellas for 10 plus years. Well, thank you so much. I've been writing since 2016. But when I started publishing, blogging seemed to be on the way out and people didn't like it. People were going down this route of video essays and turning every script into a YouTube video, which was supported with facts, figures, graphics on the screen. And I did what was popular, and it worked for a while until I was deplatformed from YouTube. But I do enjoy writing far more than I enjoy doing video essays, because when you do a video essay, a third of the time is spent producing the content. A third of the time is spent recording it and editing it down, maybe more, in fact. And then another roughly a third is spent putting in the graphics, doing all the artwork and the design. And now two thirds of that process has gone. So I can do two longer articles per week. And I actually find the writing part of the process to be the most fun, the most gratifying. I don't know about you, Morgoth, but how did you feel about the move to video essays? And do you prefer it now that blogging is coming back and the video essay is sort of a sort of relic of 2016 to sort of 2018?
Yeah, in a way, I'm quite sad. I mean, I started out blogging and then I moved into, like you said, my earlier videos were pretty rough around the edges because I didn't understand any of the technical stuff. And then my videos got more and more extravagant, but it's so much hard work. Like a 12-minute video would be like 15, 16 hours work when you add it all up. And then my YouTube channel was demonetized years ago. And I also just think YouTube's a terrible platform to kind of stake your, you know, plant your flag on. And then when Substack came around, blogging came back, and I thought, well, I always preferred blogging, and I jumped back into it. But one of the nice things about Substack is that it's kind of multifunctional, so you can do videos on it, but few people ever do. But you can just upload like a sort of podcast that I do sometimes, where I'll just do like, say, a 20-minute monologue or something to share my thoughts about something. So there's that as well. And I try to kind of break it up a bit. But yeah, I was happy to see it. I was surprised to see it return because, like you, I thought, well, everybody just wants to listen now and blogging's dying out. But it came back. With Substack, as I say, you can use it for other things. I mean, I was early on there. I've been on it for like 4 years, and I think it's a great platform. I don't hear of hardly anybody getting banned. In fact, I don't think anybody's been banned at all. But then again, I don't sort of deliberately push the limits or anything like that anyway.
Well, look, that's the thing. I mean, you talk about pushing the limits. But I've never pushed the limits. When I was on YouTube, I have never produced a video or a script that wasn't checked by a UK, by an English solicitor. I've always done everything by the book. But YouTube was one of those weird platforms where they would one day you'd be fully monetized, making great money, top of the algorithm. 2 weeks later, your channel was partially demonetized. A load of your videos had been, you know, flagged, and you'd got loads of warnings, and you're on the way out, and it would just be a small change would destroy your channel. Whereas I feel with Substack, I've only been doing it for 5 weeks. I've only got 11 essays up there, but it does seem that people respond well to long form, carefully written, well presented articles. And I also think those articles in that form are more easily referenced. So if you produce things in video essay format, you can go back and find them. But to find a specific paragraph or bit of information, it's hard to do. Whereas in blog format, very easy to do with a quick search. And I think it could be more useful. But please check out my Substack, because as I said, we've lost entropy.
That's what I was. It's funny enough, because somebody said to me this week, there was something came up on the news, and there was a thing about the Bulger killings, and I wrote an essay called Britain is a Madhouse, and I kind of got into how the Bulger killings were handled back in the day, that Jamie Bulger, I remember, and it was all over the news forever and ever. And I was contrasting that with what happened at Southport, and the big thing was that the Bulger killings were actually politicized. And I went back and I researched, what did John Major, who was a prime minister at the time, say? What did Tony Blair say, who was in the opposition? And it was John Major, for example, his reaction was that there's too much of this kind of namby-pamby psychologizing. Basically, he was saying young men need to be have more of the rod. They need to be more tough discipline. And Tony Blair typically was saying, well, we have to look at the deep aspects of society and all of that. But it wasn't a racial issue because we weren't really a multicultural society. But when you change the dynamics and you bring in and you compare it to the reaction of Axel Rudakabana, you don't even know who is you and who isn't anymore. And somebody asked me about this, and I could immediately go back and just say, yeah, here it is. And I linked them to the article. I took a little screenshot of the passage. And so it's much more difficult to do that if it's buried in like a 2-hour live stream or somewhere on a video essay, sort of halfway through 20-minute video. So that in that way, like, blogging is much better.
As I said, I also find it easier to flesh things out. I think when you're producing video essays, you often make compromises to shorten things because you want to keep it 12 to 15 minutes. So it's only sort of 14 to 18 hours work. Whereas when you're blogging, you know, a good 4 to 6 hours writing can turn out 3,000, 3,500 words. It's a lot better. It flows a lot better and you can add things in. So, and I like personally when I'm reading, and I remember this from back in the day when I used to buy sort of computer game magazines, I liked really dense articles that, you know, tons of words that went really deep into the issue that you were reading about. I love those deep dives. I hated the more superficial writing where you'd get kind of like, you know, a couple of little paragraphs and it was mainly just screenshots. And some people like that because they bought the magazines to see the latest screenshots, what's coming up, what does it look like. But I like those big in-depth, this is exactly what you're going to get, these are the subtle nuances, etc. And I prefer that to write like that too. So I really enjoy it and it's good. Bodda Nilsson gave a gifted sub. Thank you so much. Flemish Fighter also gave a gifted sub. Thank you so much. And Flemish Fighter gave $20. Thank you very much. And said, our future is heading towards balkanization. We should prioritize taking over local councils through resettlement. Or should we spend another decade trying to convince the NPC public through politics? Look, I'll let Morgoth give his opinion, but I'll be very brief on this. I've said this. If nationalists were serious about power, they would quit trying to win the whole country back. They would move to designated areas that were sort of 90% plus white, that were old sort of labor heartlands, white working class places where people have got similar sensibilities to us. And dozens, if not hundreds, of nationalist families would move to similar areas, buy up cheap new build estates, or, you know, where they're cul-de-sacs, so there's one way in, one way out, you can't drive through them, they've all got their own little field with children's play stuff on it, they've all got the ability to turn somewhere into a community center. We would be clustering in those areas, and then we would use our base there to win local power, elect ourselves, pull up the drawbridge, and create workable, intentional communities in places where people can live a relatively normal life, where there's jobs, where there are schools that we can take over and get on the board of governors, where there are community centres we can buy up, where there's local scouting movements that we can get involved in, where there's a local food bank so we can help local people and bring them on board. We should be doing that intentionally. The idea that we can take back the whole country and that 10 nationalists in Birmingham and 10 in Nottingham and 10 in Leicester and 10 in Leeds can turn those cities around via some long march through the ladder strategy politics, complete crap. It can't be done now. The only way is balkanization and us living together.
Yeah, I watched a video on the micro parties before, so I knew where you were on this. I thought it was good. I thought it was I agreed with what I'll say on the normie NPC thing. I think we have to sort and get over this. We've long had this view that there's activists, there's people online, there's people in small political parties. There's a kind of small network of enlightened people, and then you've got this like giant mass of normies who just watched East Enders and Coronation Street, and they don't know anything. And I think that was true in the past. I don't think it's true anymore. I mean, I did an article on Substack called Reforming Normies, where I think what's happening, firstly, is that just what people are seeing on the street in their real lives off the internet is radicalizing them a lot, because it's no longer this abstract, a sort of abstract theory where people say, I wouldn't care if I was the only white person around, is now I am the only white person around. And there's a hell of a difference in that. It's now real, and it's affecting people in the real world. And then on top of that, you know, everybody's like boomer parents is on WhatsApp. This is not to say that the normies are reading Culture of Critique or anything like this. But what they are doing is sharing the sort of the daily rape story that comes out of the Daily Mail. And I know this because I'm bombarded with WhatsApp of horror stories all the time from like me sister and all of these people. And they're like, and it didn't used to be the case, and it is now. And I think all of these people are hurtling towards voting for reform. But what they're doing is sort of setting it out. So everybody in the society is being politicized and choosing which side they're on. This is going to mean that you're going to have lots of young women move over towards the Greens, but you're going to have more and more white people moving further and further towards us. Or, I mean, a party like Reform, you can see it reflected in the polls. So it's not to say everybody's being red-pilled, but the whole country's just been radically politicized because of the material conditions that they live with and see every day. The daily rape, a random stabbing, crime statistics, all the rest of it. Who's on the dole? Who's claiming benefits? This is just shoved down everybody's face now and shared around on their WhatsApp and Facebook pages. So all the normies are kind of moving there now anyway.
I think we're getting to a point, though, and I think this is a particularly interesting issue. And I've said this before. You've roughly got 70% of the country that are white Britons. Now, I think there's a high watermark of around 50% of white Britons that would vote for an anti-immigration party. I can't see it going beyond that because there's just too many self-hating whites out there. Do you think that it would be possible to win a general election? And if you do, how many more electoral cycles do you think we've got before you think it would be impossible?
I think it depends on the policies and how you handle it. So if we say reform comes in and in 2029, which is already like many, many more migrant births, they've already got a hell of a job on their hands, so you may just get it done. But there's a problem with what you're actually going to promise and how this is going to be handled. Now, I don't actually believe that you should just sort of go for the maximalist position. You can hold that inside your head where, you know, you're just trying to get everybody out of the country as fast as possible. I would actually salami-size it and use data. So you've got who are the most problematic groups, who is committing the most crime, who is doing all of these rapes, and obviously the asylum seekers and whatnot, and you just immediately get rid of them because the data says they're a hell of a burden on society. And then you just keep moving up and you say, right, who's next? Which is the next most problematic group? And that's how I would actually do it. And so you're not really going to scare the chickens, so to speak. But how long you've got to even do that, I don't know. But in terms of getting our sort of the country back to where it was in 1950, I just don't think that's ever going to happen. But because people are getting scared and there's a lot of crime and there's a lot of violence, there's going to be easily identifiable groups that you can get rid of. based purely on data, crime statistics, and facts, where the argument to keeping them is very difficult to do. That's how actually I would actually approach it. So it isn't this kind of hard. I mean, as I started off talking about like revolutionary, this is the sort of not so much a revolution or a slow one. Whereas if you go for the maximalist position, then you're talking about hell on earth breaking loose. I mean, you're not going to get some sort of financial crash because you've removed all of the foreign criminals for your country, for example. But how many election cycles? I think 2029 is probably going to be the last one for a major push.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much in line with what I've said. I said at a real push, you would get sort of 2034. And at that point, and I don't know what your position is on this, you then are basically going to say we live in a multi-ethnic sectarian society, and to win power on a national level, we would have to reach out to ethnic minorities whose interests lay in either peaceful separation, or they personally wanted to be the minority that were favored in a much more white country. And at that point, then you have to do some kind of bargain because you need those people to be able to win. And one thing that did actually shock me, I'm just going to Google this, but I don't know if you saw, but Birmingham Council, their election results were actually quite interesting because Labour lost, okay? Labour lost, but Reform actually did very well. And that was really interesting. So Reform did very well in that. So if you look at how Birmingham City Council is now composed, I would say that could be a frightening look at how Britain's parliament would be when white Britons are the largest minority. So the Conservatives took 16 seats, Reform took 23, the Greens are on 19, Labour took 16, the Liberal Democrats 12, and then there were 13 independents and one for the Workers' Party. Well, that's incredible, isn't it? That's like this bizarre representation where, strangely, Reform are the biggest party, which obviously largely came from, you know, the 40 sort of 2% white Brits that still live there. But for actual legislative power, Reform would need to reach out to the other parties. And I think, unfortunately, that's where definitely post 2034 and potentially post 2029, that's how it's looking if you want to wield national power.
Yeah, and another issue where if you're going into sectarianism and kind of even before you get to the coalition building, you're going to have an organization or a figurehead or a leader that represents a clearly identifiable group. So, one of the things that happens, what happens time and time again, is that people will say, why is it, for example, there's community leaders for Muslims, for Pakistanis, there is Pakistani community leaders, but there's no white community leader. And even the idea of there being a white community leader leads you into trouble with the law and with the state itself. And we can't go on with this. If something like grooming gangs happen, if something like Southport happens, there needs to be a person in the country who is the white person, who is representative, who is the white community leader. And this obviously, even to speak of this, this is the exact situation that the regime is terrified of. Because if they admitted that, then they would admit that multiculturalism has completely failed. And then each of these different sort of groups in this newly sectarian country needs representation. And if they admit that the white British need specific representation, they've admitted that it was all a failure all along. And it's never going to be. We didn't turn in to this sort of mass of consumers with no identity except like Netflix and iPhones. That just didn't happen. Kind of human nature reasserted itself. And this is the situation that we're in. We need, and in a way, when you look at the voting patterns, you see the rise of Restore, you see this massive swing to Reform. This is what people are crying out for. They see, rightly or wrongly, in someone like Rupert Lowe or Nigel Farage, a kind of proxy for what they want, which is representation.
Agreed. All right, we've got a couple of super chats left. If you want a super chat, please do. Obviously, you know, this has massively affected me, Entropy disappearing. Unfortunately, that was my largest stream of income each month. It is now completely gone. If you did support me on Entropy, please go over to Rumble and send something, or please go to Substack and subscribe. I really, really do need people to do that. If that doesn't somehow materialize, that is really going to harm me. So please, please do that. And remember, I don't take a wage from PA or from anywhere else. Pops and Me 22 told me how to find Paul Miller. Thank you so much. He says, go to crusaders.gg. That's his platform. Well, thank you so much. And Flemish Fighter gave $10. Thank you very much. And said, Christianity succeeded by blending with German folkish ancestry focus and warrior elements. Today's universal for everyone approach feels in churches too off-putting. There is no vitality and no seriousness. Look, I completely agree with that. And, you know, the Christianity that was there in my youth seemed to bind people. It seemed to be strong. It seemed to be moralistic. What you get in a lot of churches is off-putting. And I actually think it's the liberal universalism that has killed the church. I don't think the church was pushing liberal universalism that killed the West. I think the church got co-opted like every other institution did in the West. And it is that co-option that has damaged it. I don't know what you think to that, Morgoth, but I don't think Christianity, well, when I was young, it just wasn't that universalist thing. You know, it was, and now seeing it erased from schools and everywhere else that it has been, if Christianity was the thing that was destroying the West, they'd want more of it in schools, not less of it in schools.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to look back on the past. We had like the greatest empire in history when we were like devout Christians, and there was no universalism in that. There was a clear distinction between who was the foreigner, who was Indian or who was African, and who was us. There was almost like a kind of missionary zeal there, perhaps, but there was certainly no racial egalitarianism or woke mumbo jumbo. It was, if anything, the white supremacist. And that all happened when we were Christians.
Agreed. And that's a nice place to end it. We've hit the 2-hour mark, and Morgoth has been already very, very generous agreeing to appear. And he's also been very kind by sharing my Substack and helping me get the word out that I am actually writing now regularly. And you can do that too by going to Substack, following me. It is free, and you can also pay for a subscription. That would really help. Morgoth, it's been great having you on. What are your final thoughts before we shut things down?
Well, I think it's an interesting time. There's certainly discussions happening that we wouldn't have dreamed of 5 years ago. But we're really kind of up against the clock here for any kind of serious change. And there's probably going to be a lot of more unpleasantness coming as well. I mean, one thing I will say, just to sort of reiterate it, I think these kind of right-wing parties, Restore, Reform, should be getting ahead of the sort of collapse of globalism that we're seeing and just embracing a more kind of inward-looking nationalist politics, not just because like, we're nationalists, but because that's where the future is headed. We're going to have to focus more on our own country and what goes on in it than these kind of infinite supply chains and trinkets coming in from China on the cheap all the time.
I agree. And you know what, Morgoth? One day you and I are going to have to sit and talk about Restore and Reform, because I don't know if you've been listening to me, but I've got some real concerns. And my concern is, I'm not a big fan of Farage. But Reform is knocking it out of the park electorally and seems to have the momentum. I am a bigger fan of Rupert Lowe in what he says or what he said so far, although I can kind of read the tea leaves and think there's going to be a rug pull at some point. But my concern is if the two take each other on and split the vote, and this is what I've been saying consistently since Restore was announced, that might be the issue that gifts the next general election to some ungodly leftist coalition, Green Labour. And where do we end up then? Have you thought about that? What's your feeling about a potential vote split? Just very quickly.
Well, my issue with Reform is that I just don't trust them. I don't trust Farage and I don't trust the Tories. I mean, I've almost been seeing it as if it's just like the Tories 2.0. My hatred of the Tories runs so deep that, I mean, I'm not the only one who said this. It isn't a sort of cutting edge take. But when you see some of the people that they've flooded Reform in with, I just think, really, it's a kind of choice of Fell For It Again awards, because there are criticisms going on of Restore. I said on a stream like a week or two after the party kicked off that there seemed to be like a real disconnect. When you hear Rupert Lowe speaking in an interview, he's not coming out with anywhere near what the base is saying on Twitter. And to what degree is he aware of what's going on in his name, in the name of his party? It is worthy of a larger discussion at some point, because he's got this whole thing about like delegating power. And I think what tends to happen is that everybody just thinks, well, okay, there doesn't seem to be a consistent party line. Which one is going to, is it going to be the based Restore of Charlie Downs, or is it going to be the kind of warmed over Thatcherism of Rupert Lowe? And I don't see this. I think we're heading for Broken Heart Pass here, because there's going to be a lot of people. This is going to come to a head. It almost did over the weekend, because some girl got dropped from giving a talk or something. And hopefully they can rectify it. But as for the splitting the vote, I'm kind of like, well, I just see Reform as Tories.
Is it better to bulldoze the system with Reform and then try and sort that out afterwards? Or is it better to gift our last chance to Labour? And I think it's a difficult position. But what I will say is, and this is, I think you're very right in what you're saying, and I want to focus more on what you said than my previous points, because you brought up something that I've also been touching on. I think X has become, and look, I'd love to be back on X. I'm not saying people should leave X, but I think X has become very much an echo chamber where people believe what they see. It wasn't long ago that people were absolutely supporting Homeland on X, and it seemed that, like, Homeland's going to win. Homeland is the next party. They're going to come to power. Oh, you know, remigration now, it's going to happen. You know, and all these stupid memes were going around of green planes with remigration now plastered on the side. You know, everyone in the comments was, you know, vote Homeland, they're going back. They stood an election and none of their candidates got above 1%, and they're now dead. And when I look at this, I think to myself, we're seeing these very insular, self-inflating bubbles pop up on X, where people get involved in this circle jerk, and over time they convince themselves that their point of view is held by everyone. You know, I just posted this. It got 500 likes. It got 40 retweets. Everyone in the comments was loving it. It's happening. But that doesn't translate to real world power. And my concern is that a lot of what's being said on X is basically whatever Elon Musk wants to be said. It's his little playground. He enjoys it. It might translate in some ways in America, but I don't think it's translating to what you see in these recent council elections. You know, if you look at what happened in those council elections, the Tories still came fourth Labour still came second, but there's no buzz for them on X. The Greens smashed it and out of nowhere took like 500 and something seats, which is a record for them. But there's no buzz for them on X. But and all the buzz is for this sort of really hard line form of nationalism. But I don't see that reflected in the actual polls. And I wonder if people are getting trapped in something that doesn't potentially exist in the real world. And when they realize it doesn't, it's going to be very deflating and very upsetting for people.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's definitely it. There's definitely a chance of that. Yeah.
Right, well, thank you so much. And obviously, we'll have a proper chat about this sometime. We just have three more super chats. Thank you so much. Rich17810 gave $5. Thank you so much for coming in at the last minute, guys. And he said, Rupert is a slightly less zogged version of Boris. Donald Ducktator gifted a sub. Snazzy Candidate gifted $8. Thank you so much. And said, hi, Morgoth and Mark. Best wishes. Well, thank you for the $8. And thank you to everyone. Thank you to Morgoth. Thank you to all those who donated. If you want to donate offline, you can donate at any time through Rumble. Please do. There's hundreds of people watching tonight and only about a dozen or so gave. Please do. And please, to everyone who used to support on Entropy, please find a way to subscribe to me and help me out as you were doing, because most of my income has now disappeared. You can follow me and subscribe to me over on Substack. I'm very active there. And I promise you my writings are worth reading. And finally, you can support via crypto. It's been a great show. I can't thank Morgoth enough. He is the best of British. He's wonderful. It's always great having him on. Thank you for being here. Thank you to everybody who donated. From the bottom of my heart, I appreciate it so much. And thank you to everyone who tuned in. I'll be back later in the week, and I'll be back next week for another episode of Patriotic Weekly Review. Thank you all. I love you.